Good morning. So first of all, I've not been on the board. I've been an executive officer, but don't besmirch my name. But a lot of people who read these slides and looked over and pointed out that I'm doing this in reverse. So I'm going to talk actually about the Apache Way, about our ideals of meritocracy, and then about how to improve our inclusion. So if you saw the last speech, I hope you will not be bored. I think you will not be, because we cover a lot of things. But first of all, let's talk about me. I am the VP of Fundraising. I am the Chair Emeritus of the Spam Assassin Project. For those of you who are Canadian, you will appreciate this. I have signed my initials since I was 14 years old, which are KAM. This apparently is a brand of Canadian spam, so I think it was very fitting. When I found out about it, it became my instant avatar. And about 3 weeks ago, a friend of mine who originally introduced me to this can of spam, or off-brand spam, brought a case back from the border and had to explain to the border guard why they had a case of CAM with them. They explained it to me, and I think out of that conversation, I've been offered Canadian citizenship just for that. So in my day job, I do high target, high value asset protection, defend, assess, restore, and recover nuclear nation state level security. I work at InfraShield. That's not public information at the moment. So I thought we'd get started by telling you about my oddest resume entry. So many years ago at Virginia Tech, there apparently is a tradition of doing this that I did not know about. I thought I just had some drunk friends who wanted to go out and push some cows over. And if you've never heard of this before, it's a concept that you can go and tip cows over when they're sleeping. It's completely an urban legend. I think MIT has now figured out the exact number of joules that you need to apply to a cow in a certain position to actually knock them over, and it's a lot. So we decided to instead paint the cows. And because we're engineers, we brought straight rules. We used the proper colors and painted things like our college logo on the cows. We also painted our rival school, which is UVA, and put things like UVA sucks across the cows. It was great. And one day we were getting chased off the farm for the second time, and the first time we had gotten shot with rock salt, so we were hurrying out of there, and the farmer comes running after us screaming, and eventually he gets our attention and says, stop, and we're like, okay, and we're like, don't shoot us with rock salt again, and he goes, no, I want to hire you guys. Your cows you've been painting, I've been getting like 50 extra bucks when I go to auction with them. So I became a professional livestock painter. All right, so part one, we're going to talk about what is the ASF. So the ASF is a charity. We're a 501c3. That's the chapter in the United States that makes us a charity. We're different than 501c6s, which are trade organizations. That's very common in the open source world. And we're known for the HTTP server. That's the granddaddy of our organization. And the Apache software license, or the ASL, or the ASL V2, which is the version 2 of that license. What is our mission? So our mission is to provide software for the public good. One of the key points you'll notice here that Shane brought up, and I'll also hammer here, is we do it at no charge. We don't provide free software. Free software is a landmine in the open source world as to whether or not you're talking about open source or software that you can use or what you can do with it. And one of the things that we talk about, and you can see me quoted on it, is take our software, download it, make it commercial, make a $1 billion company out of it, you owe us nothing. It is truly open source software at no charge. So the Apache license, one of the reasons I became involved with the ASL is because I love the ASL V2, I love the pro-business stance, I love the way of doing these things. If you get down to it and you started debating politics with me, I live in Washington, D.C., I can debate politics all day long, it is the sport du jour where I grow up. And I will do it all day long. And I'll probably tell you at the end of the day I'm a socialist, but I don't think socialism has a realistic chance in hell. And other licenses are similar. They have great ideals, but they won't work. The ASL V2, in my opinion, especially because of its pro-business stance, its patent grants, and no copyleft provisions, is a realistic way to make open source work. So, can you hear me okay? All right, so these are three of the points that I like to bring up with sponsors. They're very, very powerful, but it talks about how the ASF, we've become almost hidden. We're so intrinsic in how the internet works that people, to some extent, don't know about us. You know, 80% of the world's websites use our software. You know, name a blue chip company that isn't using Apache, you know, whatever, Hadoop, Mesos, Spark, Spam Assassin. You know, it drives the current IT economy. Additionally, every smartphone on the planet has our software on it, just a fact. And one of the ones I like is every plane in US airspace is tracked with our software. So, you know, three really, really, really large uses of our software, and a lot of people just don't know about it. So, all right, so two of the places I like to point out, one of them's brand new, projects.apache.org. You can go here, you can see an automated page that goes through our many, many projects. We have over 350 projects. I believe we have 319 TLPs. We have 53, though I think that's closer to 55 incubating projects. Incubator is how we bring new projects into the ASF. And you know, we have almost 200 committees that manage these projects. A recent addition that I really like to show off, go to apache.org/logos. It shows some of the wonderful contributions by graphics artists to our projects and, you know, just the vision of how we do things. So a great website with lots of neat logos you can scroll through. So talking more about it, you know, from A to Z, you know, I like to point out, you know, just we cover everything from, you know, ActiveMQ to Xerxes. But I do point out that I cheated when I said Xerxes because it's actually spelled with an X. But, you know, it's, you know, one of the things that I like to talk about is how projects get named, how companies get named. And Xerxes, you know, literally went in the dictionary, looked up what words were available, cross-referenced it to what domain names were kind of available. That's how they named it. And if you look at this process, that's how a lot of great, great companies start. But we really do have a Z. We have Apache Zookeeper. So that's a centralized process for maintaining, you know, your various group services. In any case, I thought I'd start out with a quiz. Now, this is an ApacheCon, so when I throw this quiz some other places, it doesn't usually get answered. But who here can tell me why Hadoop is called Hadoop? Oh. All right, Daniel, go ahead. That is correct. It is Doug Cutting's daughter, Stuffy. It was named Hadoop. So when I tell you can name a company off of anything, Apache Hadoop was literally named after a stuffed animal. So now the follow-up on that is, you know, big data. You know, that falls into the category of what people call big data, distributed storage with Hadoop and whatnot, things that are so voluminous. I love this definition from Wikipedia, so I'll read it verbatim. So, big data is data sets that are so voluminous and complex that traditional data processing application software are inadequate to deal with them. So, have you guys ever heard the term backronym? That's when you create an acronym, but you pick what your acronym is going to be first, and then you figure out what it's going to stand for. This is, I think, a back definition, because it's not why it was called big data, really. It's kind of an interesting thing. Engineers and whatnot get involved in naming things, and stuffed animal names come out. But does anybody know why it was called big data? So where do elephants live? They live at the circus, and they're big, and they have tents. I swear to God, that's pretty much where they came up with the term big data. Which also, if you start thinking about it, is why we're a bunch of clowns, and we have things like Apache Big Top. It'll start making more sense about where we come up with these things with elephants and clowns and big tops and zookeepers and whatnot. It's a very minor thread. So anyway, hopefully you learned some stuff about that. We're incorporated, we're almost 20 years old. Next year will be our celebration of our 20th anniversary, our 20th birthday, excuse me. This is our 20th year of doing ApacheCon. So thank you all for coming and supporting it. All right. So what are we? So we're not a democracy. You know, I like to point out that we are elitists. We don't believe people have an innate right to vote. We're not capitalists. You know, we are a charity. You cannot buy a seat on our board. We're not a monarchy. You know, kings and pawns work side by side. As Shane pointed out, there's people who are literally CTOs of major corporations, people that have, you know, eight figures in the bank that work alongside people that are probably scraping to eat ramen day by day and have equal merit. And because of that, we are a meritocracy. You know, basically, your worth is judged by the community. This is a real key part of the Apache way, is that you earn merit. And why do we exist? Well, as a foundation, you know, one of the biggest reasons we exist is to provide resources. You know, back in the day, 20 years ago, it was difficult to get a server up in the cloud, have a mailing list and stuff like that. So we existed to kind of lighten the load on just providing those kind of administrivia resources. Legal protection, probably the biggest reason. People don't necessarily understand it, but you know, lawyers can be a big pain in the butt, so it's a good reason to have legal protection. Come under a corporate umbrella, protect yourself so you don't have to worry about that. Recognition, you know, belonging to the Apache Software Foundation brings a lot of gravitas to a project. It gives it some immediate credibility. And additionally, community. You join a community of almost 7,000 committers, 700 members, and you know, people that are interested in making the world a better place through open source software. All right, quiz break. All right, so before there were emojis, there were something else. Anybody know the name of these? The smileys is close. So the proper name of them, from an old person like me, is these are called emoticons. So emoticons predated emojis before we could do pretty graphics and whatnot. So anybody know what this one says? Anybody drink coffee? That was Starbucks. So this one, so this is me as a doctor, that's a stethoscope. We had all kinds of these. This one has two answers. Anybody tell me what this one is? So this is me wearing a tie, though I had an audience point out that it looks more like me wearing a fish. So I don't know what culture they wear fishes in, but apparently it's me wearing a fish. All right, so very important. You now know emoticons. You know, we used to do lots of ASCII art, so lots of stuff. All right, so the Apache way. So, you know, one of the big things, and I stole this from Daniel, who's in the back, and I told him I was going to steal it, was, you know, if you've seen one Apache way presentation, you've seen one Apache way presentation. This is yet another the Apache way presentation, so that's what that acronym stands for. You'll get a little bit out of everybody who does it, everybody who embraces it, and hopefully there will never be consensus on what is the Apache way, because that would be very un-Apache-like if we did. But I will point out that one of the things I've noticed over the years and personally went through is people hate the Apache way for a few years. You know, you struggle with, why the hell am I doing this? Why does Dad want me to you know, do this particular chore? But if you embrace it, you know, there is light at the end of the tunnel, and you realize why it's done the way it's done and why it has survived for almost 20 years now, and I hope it will survive for another 20 years plus. So we are a charity. We're decentralized. One of the things about that organization is we are bottom up. So our projects support the foundation. They run the way they want to run within reason, and they exist to support the foundation, and the foundation exists to support them in a very circular manner. Community. So this took a long time for me to really appreciate as a PMC chair. I just want to check my time. Okay. As a PMC chair, because communities is really the most valuable thing. We have a thing called the attic, where code goes to live when it dies, because that's a natural life cycle for software. You know, it's going to eventually reach its life and its usefulness, and so it needs to go to the attic. And so one of the things we do is we build communities. We want people to go on to the next project, build something else, build the next software that changes things. And one of the ways we do that is we try and support minority voices. And that's where we talk about things like building support rather than votes, consensus. We won't necessarily say that votes never occur, but a lot of people are very loath to take a vote that they don't think will be 100% unanimous. So that's not a bad thing. You have to kind of balance it. So the way we build consensus, we do a very interesting voting thing, and you'll see this come through if you read our voting lists, or excuse me, our mailing lists. You know, plus one, zeros, and negative ones. Negative one is kind of like I really, really don't agree with this. Plus one is, I agree with this. There's actually a ++1 that you every once in a while see that says, I really, really, really agree with this. You know, other than that, you can have lazy consensus. You can basically say, over the next 72 hours, I'm going to do this unless somebody steps forward and says this is a bad idea. So there's a ways to build consensus through you know, what's called lazy consensus. That's not allowed for things like voting, or for voting for releases and whatnot. But the key point is consensus and unanimity are not necessarily the same thing. You know, people can agree to disagree, and that's an important tenet. Oops, sorry. So we talked about a merit, you know, so power, if you will, is earned through merit. People, you know, do good things and they earn merit and they're recognized by the community for that, and that is how we run. In my opinion, and I like to point this out, the most merit is earned by people with ideas that also enact those ideas. I got tons of people who will, you know, give me negative feedback on an idea. I got tons of people that will give me ideas they want me to implement. I have very, very few people that step forward and say, here's a great idea and I'm going to do it. So, you know, if you are one of the people that has an idea, I will tell you that there's a hidden bit of meritocracy, which is the JFDI principle, which is the just F and do it principle, which just basically says, if you have an idea, step up, be transparent about it, say what you want to do, and do it, and build consensus. And you can build consensus doing things like, I think this is a great idea, get somebody else on board with it, get two people on board with it, but you know, also think about building lazy consensus. I'm going to go prove you wrong by doing it, and let's see what it comes out. Nobody's going to stand in your way in those type of situations. We're a bunch of volunteers. So, all right, everyone at the Apache Way is an individual. They don't represent a company. They don't represent anything but themselves. So when they vote from that standpoint with you. When you earn merit, it follows you no matter what company you work at, et cetera. But with merit, and one of the biggest risks, if you actually read more about meritocracies, is the concern that basically it turns into a dictatorship. And so what we try and make sure the worst type of dictatorship that we have at the ASF is what we call a BDFL, which is a benevolent dictator for life. Those are usually people that have earned so much merit through time and work that people are afraid of them. Either their shadow is very big, so people don't want to step into their shoes, or they say something and it's not really meant to be authoritative, but it comes across as authoritative, or people perceive it as authoritative. You know, but that's the kind of the biggest problem that we have is BDFLs. And so one of the big problems, yeah, or one of the things with inclusion is to try and make sure that BDFLs sometimes recognize when they are BDFLs and tone their statements down and whatnot. So we'll get to some of that stuff in the inclusion section. All right. So next thing really is the Apache Way and talking about transparency. We try and run very, very, very transparently. Things are archived. We talk about things happening on list. If you have a phone call, there needs to be contemporaneous notes. We try and keep those type of things to a minimum. It can be very, very frustrating. But because of this, you know, everything we do has a discussion. Everything we do has a decision. Everything we do is in an archive. And we have projects like Pony, which runs, I think the website is list.apache.org. Can anybody confirm for me? Don't know. Okay. That's right. Okay. So Pony, for example, is one of our top level projects. It exists to let us go and look at our mail archives and do so in an easy way and give a permalink out to people and say, hey, here's where the discussion was done. Great, great tool. And one of the other things that they try and make sure that they do is try and do things in reversible baby steps. You know, this allows for change management that can be done and turned back if it needs to be. It's not always possible, but it's a great ideal to hit for. All right. Story break. Okay, so I didn't want to bore you with a whole bunch of talks about various Apache stuff without telling you some stories, so I thought today I would tell you the story of my grandfather. So my grandfather was a bit of a prankster. He was a good guy, but I'm Irish, at least in my heritage. If you guys are familiar with the musical, you know, I've told my wife when I die, she has to play It's the Nicest Thing Anybody's Ever Done for You, for me, which is a song they sing when Scrooge dies and everybody's singing on Dancing on His Grave. So I told her she has to play that at my funeral. But my grandfather died on April Fool's Day, and I just thought I would tell you that it was one of the hardest discussions I've ever had because my family called and said, Kevin, you need to call and let the extended family know. And my day for about 12 hours went like, hi, I'm calling to tell you, you know, Grandpa died. Yes, I know it's April Fool's. No, this is not a joke. Yes, you can call my dad. He'll tell you it's not a joke. Okay, I got like 400 people to call. I got to go. Okay, click, phone rings. Yes, he's really dead. This is not a joke. So I thought that was a good story and you guys would appreciate it, but I'm pretty sure he died on that day just to make my life difficult. So, yeah. All right. So getting back to the Apache Way, we are finishing up, I think, on the Apache Way type stuff. But the Apache Way, it's very pragmatic. I told you a little bit about why I support it from a business standpoint. It promotes visible code. It promotes reusable code. But some of the things that sponsors really appreciate, but also I think users of it, it's risk mitigation. You know, you don't have to worry about a company going out of business or end of lifing a product. You've got the product right there. Even if it serves its useful life from what the project deems, it goes in the attic. You can download it. The code's there. You can change it. You can compile it, give it a new life. You know, make a company around it. It has the ability to what we call control your destiny. You know, nothing we do is end of life. So an open source gives you that. Other proprietary software don't, you know. It can be bought by XYZ big company, and the next thing you know, it's completely different than it was before, or it has a sales model that doesn't agree with what you want to use. Open source doesn't have that issue. So a lot of risk mitigation because you control your destiny. Additionally, no copyleft. Copyleft is basically a play on the word copyright, where basically if you make changes to code and you distribute that code, that you must open source that code. The ASF does not have that. I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing, but similar to socialism versus capitalism or democracy, it's pragmatic. It was a way to make it work. It is proven to be the most functional open source license, in my opinion, because it works. And you know, one of the points that I like to bring out, Dries and myself both agree very strongly, you know, say you're looking at the ASL V2 or you're looking at the GPL V3 and you're not sure which one to do, pick the ASF V2 and start there. You can actually kind of, if you will, switch to the GPL V3 fairly easily from the ASL V2. It's almost impossible the other way around. I won't say it hasn't happened, but doing it and following all the dotting all your I's and crossing all your T's to achieve that from a real legal framework would be difficult. So additionally, you know, this was a quote. I once used a specific GPL licensed product, and this was a direct quote. This was in 2017, where basically, during, if you will, an internal software audit, this was the direct quote. You know, if we ever have to go through an M&A, the GPL license will turn up in a disclosure report. When it does, the potential acquirer will cite it as a significant risk. If we have to go back to the project owner and request documentation of permission at that time, they'll have us over a barrel. Long story short of what that says is the use of GPL is a risk to venture capitalists and investors. I would not have seen it that way, but they don't view the ASL in the same light. It was very interesting to come to that standpoint. All right, so this is really, everything that I've talked about up to this point was really more to lay the framework of how the ASF works, why we work, and part of my goal, especially over the last few years, has been to try and promote inclusion. And inclusion is just really in the broadest sense, how to bring more people into the projects, how to build our communities, and as a side portion of inclusion is the concept of diversity. You know, you're not inclusive if your pool of people is not diverse. So first thing I want to talk about is, you know, at the ASF, our merit, it's not based on your sex, your age, your religion, your country of origin, your socioeconomic status, your sexual preference, if I didn't say that already, you know, cultural, physical traits, etc. You earn merit by doing good work. I do like to joke we worry about whether or not you're a cat or a dog person, but that's the only thing that we play favorites concerning. And I don't know if those bracelets are here. She's got one. So the Do IT Like a Girl was our tongue-in-cheek kind of way to promote women in technology. And I think there's a couple of them floating around here at the conference, but they're very limited at this point. So this slide was supposed to have a wonderful graphic for our community over code, but I couldn't find the stupid graphic. So it has instead a big giant orange supported graphic. So pretend that's a purple community over code graphic. But the community over code principle is really important. It took me a long time as a PMC to really remember to recognize that. You know, I can sit down, I can, you know, pull an all-nighter and work code. It's never going to produce as much code as me bringing two other people or three other people into the project. So there's a balance there of, you know, do you work on code or do you work on community? Well, when it comes down to it, work on building the community over the code. It will have a better outcome in the long run. Additionally, you know, by bringing more people in the community, you start to fix diversity. So I won't say it fixes diversity. It probably should say it's the first step in fixing diversity. You're not going to have a representative pool of diverse people on the board if your membership isn't diverse to begin with. Otherwise, you're going to be doing, you know, policies of diversity over merit and things like that that, you know, won't work, aren't sustainable. And so, you know, fixing diversity with inclusion, that's very important. Some people had some ideas about how to do that, and one of the things they talked about was BDFLs and trying to be more supportive of people who don't necessarily have the technical skill and how to get them professional guidance, how to get them the technical guidance that they need to come up to speed, and to be able to talk with the BDFLs without feeling belittled is a really big problem, because I think a lot of times, especially in the open source software, you're talking about engineers, you're talking about software programmers. I don't think they always mean to be harsh. I think sometimes they're being efficient, but they will be very blunt, and tell people like, your code's horrible, or worse, you know, your code sucks. If you look at some of the turmoil that's been occurring in certain open source projects, people know this is an issue and they need to tone it down. And especially because email is a cold medium. There's a wonderful Wired article that I like to point out when people talk about tone in email, where basically they said 50% of the time people do not know the tone of an email. So you might as well flip a coin if you think you know the tone of the person behind that email, because that's how accurate you are. So you can't fix, or you can't do that. So filling the pipeline, that's basically the way of getting more people in the community. That is the first step towards fixing diversity. So invite some people to the community. Make sure they start to do it and give them the guidance they need to become technical and professional enough to be a useful member of the community, and you will find it pays back in spades. So I like to give some tips to people that are getting involved in open source and getting involved in inclusion. The reality of the situation is that you have things called energy creatures. So I quote this a lot, DNFTEC. It actually predates for me using the internet a whole lot. This actually came from a bulletin board back in the day. So there's the quote if you ever going to read it. It's a great article. It just basically, it's really sums up applied behavioral analysis, which basically says, you know, don't give attention to behaviors you don't want to see repeated. So that's the concept of positive reinforcement. If you have a dog and you're trying to train him to, you know, go potty outside, what you do is you wait for a moment, you wait for him to naturally go potty in the right place, and you reward the dog for it. What you do not do is you do not smack the dog or give any type of negative reinforcement when it does the wrong thing. It will not figure out what to do, what the right thing is to do. And, you know, taking this out of dogs, going back to humans, the reality is there are people who feed on energy. They just exist. Some people call them trolls, some people just call them energy creatures. But like, for example, I will give you an example. So I have a friend of mine who is an energy creature. He regrets it, but when he was younger especially, he would do things like go on to Christian mailing lists and just post, there is no God, and log off, and never log on ever again. Solely knowing that there would be a thread of 5,000 responses to his post. He had no interest in the debate, no interest in, you know, debating anything. He simply was trying to rile people up. And understanding that there are people like this is very important. So the main thing is, if you have somebody that's posting a troll, most of the time the best thing to do is just ignore it. They're either trying to feed on energy or whatnot, or you're misreading their tone. That's a very common issue. But do not feed the energy creature. Very important concept for you. All right. Venn diagrams is something I talk about a lot. It comes down to the look for the common ground. Look for your overlap. Look for where there's benefits. For example, with the ASF, we are a 501c3. Companies like Comcast are C corporations. The Linux Foundation is a 501c6. You know, most people who own property probably own it in an LLC. Most lawyers work for things called a PC or a professional corporation. these different umbrellas that exist, none of them are wrong. They all exist for a reason, and you use the right umbrella for the situation at hand. Comcast, for example, is not going to become a 501c3 tomorrow. They're not going to give out free internet to everybody. There's no expectation that they do. But where I look for things, especially in my role as VP of fundraising, is the overlap. Where does the mission of Comcast, the ASF, the Linux Foundation, et cetera, all overlap? You know, I like to point out the Linux Foundation is a sponsor of the ASF. You know, it's not, people are like, oh, they're a trade organization. No, it doesn't make, they're not wrong. They're just, that's their mission and how they achieve their mission. We're a charity, it's how we achieve our mission. Comcast is a company, it's how they achieve their mission. And there's overlap in the middle. And that's why, you know, sponsors like Comcast and Linux Foundation all exist, because there's that overlap with what we do. So Venn diagrams are very important in working with communities. You have to look for the commonality. You have to look for the overlap. Do you agree on the same mission? Maybe you guys don't agree 100%. You don't have to. Agree on the middle ground, disagree on the rest, and agree to disagree. And, you know, I like to point out, for example, that, you know, in my line of work, I am 95% good, I am 3% altruistic, and I am 2% evil. And by understanding my Venn diagram, I'm able to do things like stop bad guys very well, bad actors, because I can think a little bit like how they think. And I understand that everybody has a little bit of evilness in them. So anyway, Venn diagram's very important. Talking across languages. So this is a tip I picked up from cPanel that really works well, especially when you're doing things with people where English is not their primary language. It's a great trick to know if your stuff is going to be understood by the audience you're talking to. I try and avoid too much jargon when I'm here, when I'm talking to audiences that I know are not natively speaking in English. And this is a great way to do it. So the premise basically is you load up Google Translate, you cut and paste in your text, and you translate it to some languages. And you do that in a chain. And then once you get back to a chain of about 4 to 5 languages, and you use languages from different continents, translate it back to the language you're speaking in, so in my case, English, and see if it makes sense. And if it doesn't, you probably need to think about how you wrote it, because you probably are using either too complex of grammar, too complex of terminology, and it doesn't come through. So, for example, I don't know if you guys can see that real well, but this is, for example, taking the text for the slide I just talked about, and I translate it into Spanish as the first step. For the next step, I translate it from Spanish into, I believe, simplified Chinese. And I didn't do all the steps for the purpose of this talk because I thought it would be too boring, but I then translate it back to English. And I think if you read that, it does convey what I wrote in the original one. And I'll be honest, I rewrote that slide a couple of times because the first few times I did it, it came out pretty bad. So it was a very interesting exercise to see what would translate well, what would go across languages. And if you talk about inclusion, you need to think about the fact that we are a global economy. The world is getting smaller every day, and you need to talk to people and work with people in other countries. As an American, I do apologize for Trump just right off the bat, so don't have to go into that too much on the debate here, but you need to be able to talk across languages, and that's a great technique for doing it. So another technique, I'm not really sure 100% that I like this technique, but I thought I would bring it up because some very personal friends of mine recommended it. It's worked for them. So my sister, in fact, and I know some other people who do this, does not go by Samantha. Online, she goes as Sam. People obviously assume she is a male. She is treated differently, and it has worked for her. So I point this out because places like the ASF, you can use aliases. You can use whatever. You don't have to use your real name. You can hide behind something. If you think it will give you a leg up in inclusion, do it. And there are pros and cons. Sam had become so good on her lack of gender being mentioned anywhere on the internet that she was actually not allowed into a girls club, if you will. I don't know what the specific thing, but it was basically a group for women in IT. They wouldn't let her in. So, you know, kind of the anti-inclusion issue that she hit. So I don't know that that's a big con. She was eventually able to convince them that yes, she was a female and this is why she did it. But it's certain things to mention. And I like to bring up the story. So Shannon Faulkner was, I believe, the first candidate, not that long ago, unfortunately, I think in the 90s, 96 or 99, something like that, who was accepted into the Citadel. And the way she did it is she applied. Shannon, by the way, for many people overseas especially, is a male's name, not a female's name. So she whited out all of the mention of her sex on her transcripts and sent in her application to Citadel and then showed up on day one, having been accepted to the program. Then ended up in a lawsuit that went all the way to the Supreme Court over this, where she was eventually allowed to stay in because of public funding for the Citadel and whatnot. But you know, other people have fought these battles for you. Use them, become more included. And if these tricks can help you, you know, get by little tiny stupid hurdles so people can see the merit behind you, consider doing it. So gender neutral nicknames, et cetera. Cultural pitfall. So Merle was actually the one who brought this gentleman's work up to me. It's Professor Hofstede, is I think how you pronounce his name. Is it Hofstede? I don't. Oh, no worries. Well, I did read his stuff. It's brilliant. Lots of interesting stuff. He has unfortunately changed his model away. He used to have a thing called culture. It's now called Culture Compass, but it was like culture something or other, culture insights or something like that. It was free. So if you search his name in that culture, you'll find unfortunately lots of references to a free app on the iPhone. That was wonderful. It gives different insight into just, you know, I think it was five metrics that he basically puts up, power struggles, things like, or power structures, excuse me, and how different cultures work and how you can basically view them. I also, you know, get different feeds on just cultural faux pas, things to avoid when you're in certain cities, you know, things like do you tip or not? And, you know, for me, it's an interesting faux pas that you make sometimes where I tip and then it's considered an insult that I've over-tipped. You know, things like that. You don't view it. But you want to talk to what I call cultural friendlies. These are people you know that perhaps are familiar with the culture. They won't be offended. I found many people in every culture that will be like, hey, can I ask you a silly question? Like, you know, is it okay if I wear my shoes here? No, not at all. Don't even come in here in shoes. You know, things that you wouldn't necessarily know, and you need to ask, and a lot of people just assume are known. So avoid your cultural pitfalls, talk to friendlies, read websites. His stuff is very interesting to understand the differences. And some of it also helps a lot in business. So like, for example, one of the power structures that he talks about is, for example, in India. So they have certain power structures of how employees are protected by their managers. And concepts that are very, very foreign to the United States. And I think I unfortunately have forgotten a slide in here, so I'll talk about it from memory. One of the next slides I wanted to go over is a slide that talks about different cultural terminology that can trip you up. Like, for example, in the open source world, this one has tripped us up a lot. Are there any people here from like England by any chance? No? Okay. So I'll ask you, because you're sitting in close to the front, if I said at the next board meeting we are going to table item B, what would that mean to you? Okay. Anybody else disagree with that?
Yeah, that's not how it is in Canada.
Yeah. So in
it's only the U.S. that means table.
Yeah. It's not only the U.S., but yes, it is primarily the U.S. and the countries that follow certain. It goes actually back to the Second Treaty of Versailles, apparently. So. But yes, in other countries, tabling an item means to bring it onto the table and discuss it. It has a 180-degree different definition. And I bring that up because that actually came up at the ASF and was pissing people off because they kept saying it's tabled. And they're like, why the hell aren't we discussing it then? Well, what do you mean, why aren't we discussing it? It was tabled, you know, to the predominantly Americans that were involved. Tabling meant that we weren't going to discuss it. I'm sorry? Oh, absolutely, yeah, no, and it's totally ships passing in the night, and that's one of the things that sometimes can happen is, you know, I bring it up. I've been working on the concept of an endowment, and the board hasn't approved it yet, but I had no concept that out of our board, two people had no idea what an endowment was. So I never even thought to brief the board on the question of what is an endowment. So an endowment, if anybody here doesn't know, is basically where you put a decent amount of money that you raise from sponsors and you put it in a bank account and you basically only use that money's interest that's earned off that bank account. And if you can put a sufficient amount of money in an endowment account that it runs your organization with the interest only, you have a sustainable long-term financial outlook for the organization. So to me, that was just like a fundamental, like everybody knows what an endowment was. No. Two Europeans had no idea. The concept doesn't really exist out there. So I mention these things because they're language pitfalls that you have to be aware of and don't make assumptions. So that's the end of my speech. You can now throw Rotten Tomatoes, ask questions, feedback. I am very open, by the way, especially if you email me. I have 10 more minutes, yes. If you email me and my contact information is there about ideas, especially realistic, good ways to improve inclusion in technology is something I've been working on. I've done STEM for years with both boys and girls. I have found largely that it has no bearing on sex. It has to do with interest and social pressures as to whether or not they continue in the STEM field. But it's been something I've seen. You know, when I went to tech, I'm not that old, but I'm, 45 now, there were 4 women in the engineering program. That was it. So that's not a very inclusive, ratio, if you will. It's certainly growing. But one of the interesting things is while engineers and lawyers and doctors are growing, technologists are shrinking. It's gone down from 26% to 16%. I can't quote the statistic, but if you email me, if you're interested, I can tell you the exact quote. But it's a field that's going down. Why is it going down? I couldn't tell you. I think some of it has to do with there's interest in other fields. There was a very interesting chain on the IETF where we were talking about improving the inclusion and diversity at the IETF. And somebody brought up this whole statistic about how librarians are, 46% or 26% of them are males, but 46% of the librarian directors are male. And I went, there are still librarians. My kids don't even necessarily know what a book is. So, it's a dying industry. So I don't know why inclusion in computers is going down. There seems to be a lot of effort to try and improve it, and other industries are going up. So, I think it was probably more U.S. focused, could just be based on the university that did it. Yeah. So, but it's an interesting. Why in the U.S. is it going down? So I'm very interested, especially in realistic recommendations on how to make it better, especially at the ASF. One of the ideas that we've been thinking about is. We don't have an inclusion ombudsman. We don't have anybody who could, privately be brought up with inclusion issues to try and fix them. Do we know about our inclusion? And especially at the ASF, because of the model we run on, I don't know where people work unless I ask them, and I don't need to know where they work. I don't know if they're male or female. I have a joke I talk about. It's not necessarily the greatest joke, but I have a friend whose email address is hotmama74. And, when I met him, I was like, okay, I thought you'd be female. But, he wasn't. And he originally made that email address as a troll and just stayed with it because Gmail doesn't let you change your email addresses. So, yes, you can email him at hotmama74@gmail.com. So the point being, though, is that we don't have any mechanism for measuring our inclusion, for knowing how diverse we are. No issue or no way really for people who would want to bring together or bring forward a concern to the board or any type of resolution. Nothing exists there. I don't know if we need to do a survey or add something that says, hey, will you voluntarily tell us some diversity statistics about you so that we can measure how diverse we are. But it's an interesting issue. You can't fix what you can't measure. So thank you very much. I'm welcome to take questions and whatnot, so please, standing here, somebody throw me something. Ask me why I'm so good looking, something. Yeah. 5 minutes, okay. Well, thank you.